Welcome to Fidelity Connects by Fidelity Investments Canada, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. April marks the start of the second quarter for 2021, and we're pleased to welcome back Andrew Marchese, Chief Investment Officer and Portfolio Manager. We're also now 12 months removed from the market bottoming out, and Andrew reflects on the market rotation from growth to value, and also to commodity names. As CIO, Andrew oversees the Fidelity Canada investment team, and also manages Fidelity Canadian Disciplined Equity Fund. Andrew's process with respect to earnings forecasts involves looking at a company years out and on a stock-by-stock basis. Also, Andrew shares how Fidelity analysts establish price targets for every company, accounting for earnings and other factors. With host Pamela Ritchie, Andrew looks at the vaccine rollout, bringing his unique perspective with having a pharmacology background. Andrew and Pamela also look at inflation, earnings expectations, the Canadian consumer, and ESG investing. Andrew notes that sustainable investing is further along in Europe and the Nordic countries compared to North America, and discusses Fidelity's proprietary ESG research and rating system. This podcast was recorded on April 7th, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Andrew, let's begin, if you don't mind, with inflation. Sort of the question as you, the answer that we're looking for, is inflation real, sustained? How do you look at this?
Well, kind of building on some of the things I talked about at Vision 2021 is that as the economies improve globally, you're going to get at least a cyclical uptick in the CPI. That would, you know, as economic activity intensifies, we would expect that to happen over the course of this year and possibly into next year. I think the bigger question then is, with the amount of stimulus in the system from both a monetary and fiscal perspective, does the inflation turn into more of a secular argument? And I think we, as I talked about back in January, we've kind of reached a fork in the road on that front. We have reasons to believe, with the amount of stimulus in the system, that we could embark on a multi-year time frame of which inflation kind of ticks up and ticks up and bond yields move higher in adjustment, or the situation looks a little bit more akin to Japan. And there's a lot of big secular kind of headwinds to inflation, demographics, people leaving the workforce in developed economies, technology, too much debt. So these big secular forces are kind of competing against one another. And that will kind of ferret itself out over time. But I think at least cyclically, we can expect an uptick in economic inflation. And then there's always asset price inflation, which we're seeing everywhere. So we've seen it in the equity markets. We've seen it in real estate. We're seeing it in art. We're seeing it in trading cards, like baseball cards and NFTs. And you name it. You name it as an asset class, it has gone up in price. So there's a different kind of inflation I think we also have to be worried about.
Really interesting. So now next to sort of the big question of where we are in the cycle, I kind of feel like the cycles are going by quickly, or I don't know, you know, where we are or where you think we are, but it seems like there's such a rapid pace of things moving along. What are we sitting at now?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think it's a conundrum for investors everywhere because we're kind of 12 months removed from the depths of the panic around the global pandemic and the market kind of bottoming in around late March, you know, March 23rd, I think to be exact. And not only have we moved strongly off the bottom in 12 months' time, we've cycled through some stocks from growth stocks to traditional value stocks to now some more commodity type and resource type names. And we're kind of not even 12 months into this economic recovery. So I think that's causing a lot of consternation for investors about what next from a market leadership perspective. I can say, you know, PMIs are very healthy right now, you know, in the high 50s or even 60s globally. one should believe as monetary policy and fiscal policy remains accommodative in developed economies, that you can kind of continue at that pace and the economies can continue to thrive, which I think makes stock selection turn its attention from factor-based investing or beta, which was largely leading the market since its bottoms. And then through the end of last year, we've kind of been really a rising tide raises all boats, own more beta type of investments in your portfolio to outperform, or that should be a part of leadership. Now, I think what we'll transition to, as I talked about again about in January, is we'll transition to companies have to prove it in terms of profits and cash flows. And those are going to be the equities that kind of sustain their leadership going forward. So we've come from a rising tide, raise all boats type of market to, I think, what the next year or two is going to look like is leadership will favor those companies that can meet or positively surprise on the earnings and cash flow front, and you're not paying too much for them, because I think if the economies continue to accelerate or maintain their current pace of expansion, then one would think on a multi-year basis, both the short end and the long end of the curves need to rise. So bond yields rising would be a negative for valuations in totality with those companies that have the largest PE multiples and maybe the most volatile earnings or least transparent earnings most at risk.
So with earnings, I mean, so you at Fidelity, and Fidelity generally has incredible relationships with various companies and leadership at various companies that you invest in. And obviously analysts are looking at things. I mean, what do you think of earnings expectations right now? Like, what can you tell us about what we're about to see on one level, or is everyone still just kind of waiting on that front?
Yeah, Fidelity, we take it on a case-by-case basis. I think there's some stocks out there in the market that are kind of efficiently priced, and I think the earnings and the cash flow outlook is probably pretty efficient. There are other aspects that we think are probably undervalued because the earnings and cash flow will be, and I'm not talking about, you know, 2 weeks from next Wednesday. I'm talking, you know, on a multi-year basis, probably a lot. Stand a better chance of being higher than expectations, and we're looking at those as being preferential type of investments. I think the interesting thing to note, areas of the market, I think as a theme, if you will, we moved from, if you think about the last 12 months, we moved from a work from home. Those equities that were kind of levered to the work from home aspect of the economy did really, really well. And then come about November, it was a transition to the reopening stocks, if you will, companies that really benefited from the economy getting back to normal and really kind of accelerating from this point. And in between, there's a lot of companies that don't fit into either of those two buckets, or kind of in a quasi way do. And those are the companies, you know, I won't go into names or anything, but those are the companies in a lot of ways that have performed very admirably from a, you know, profit and cash flow and revenue perspective, have kind of been forgotten about a little bit from a valuation perspective. So it's, we kind of joke around the office, it's the non-thematic thematic theme, if you will. There's a lot of companies that don't fit into that, you know, economy closing and economy reopening buckets, and they're kind of left in between. And those things are actually looking, in some cases, not all, but in some cases, very reasonable.
You kind of need an acronym for it, don't you?
Because
you got the work from home, and yeah, you sort of, you need to enter something, brand it. Very interesting. So, I mean, that sort of goes to the stock pickers market, you know, on one level, where you really have to be a bit more alert, as you say. It's not all boats being lifted in the same way.
And to that point, I mean, that's what we see in every cycle. Like when you come off the bottom, it's kind of that rising tides raise all boats. I think the one thing that was different about the last 12 months is it was more violent and faster with quicker rotations through stocks than it was in other cycles. Now, having said that, if you think about the last economic and stock market cycle, you know, kind of where we came to in kind of 2011-12, if you look at 2012 through 2015, it was really a stock picker's market. So if you want to think about where we are today and use that as kind of an analogy, once you get past the original, the initial euphoria of markets coming off the bottom, then it does always tend to turn into more of a stock picker's market. And it does so on a multi-year basis before we have to worry about the next macro discussion, which is usually kind of taking away the punch bowl, so to speak, in terms of rising rates and whatnot.
This is interesting, you know, as you say, how violent, how quick it was, because of course 2012 to 2015 was years after the original drop off. So yeah, it's interesting how fast we got there. I wanted to get your sense on sort of the views of the economy. I'm thinking particularly of Canada, the health of the consumer to an extent. There's an awful lot of discussion about housing right now. And you can see there's sort of a bubbling point, at least in the discussion. And then it seems like home prices as well. But how is the consumer? The consumer's been saving in a lot of cases. Does it look healthy?
Yeah, for those who have heard me speak before, I think pre-pandemic, I was a little bearish on the Canadian consumer. I think Australian consumer would have some similar type metrics to it, just because of the large level of debt, whereas a lot of economies in the rest of the world had already delevered. Their consumers had already delevered, so they looked a little better. But I think coming through the pandemic, even Canada's consumer has improved. So on the margin, it looks better than what it does or what it did 12 to 18 months ago. So I think, you know, from that perspective, saving rates have been good. As I said back in January, I think there is a lot of pent-up demand for goods and services. I think, you know, people in the developed world, including Canada, will spend. I think there are going to be a lot of businesses that have a lot of pricing power. So if you're worried about inflation, you want to focus on investments in companies where those businesses have pricing power. In other words, whatever you paid pre-pandemic for that good or service, if you're forced to pay 1.5, 2 times, 3 times X, I think that in a lot of cases, people will pay it. So I think, you know, and from that perspective, Canada looks better than it did 18 months ago.
Interesting. How does Canada look on the invest? Is this a bit of a moment for Canada? We've got obviously the resources, which have been doing well. Oil's been having some moments. It seems to, you know, be going back and forth a little bit. And financials. How does Canada look from an investment perspective?
Canada looks fine. You know, I'm not that fussed one way or another of Canada versus the U.S. or versus other markets in the world. I think a good diversified portfolio should include Canadian equities in it. I think, you know, the financial stocks, you know, have come through the downturn, right? Well, I think one of the things that we talked about 18 months ago, what we were worried about with the banks is that the stocks were not priced for rising levels of loan losses, right? So loan loss provision levels needed to rise. We came through that, the stocks reset. And now if you think we're in a multi-year economic expansion, then one would believe or one would conclude from that statement that you're kind of the worst is behind you in terms of loan loss provisions. And so loan growth should improve in the years ahead and PCL should remain at kind of lower levels. And that's a good place to be if you're investing in financial stocks, namely banks.
Namely banks, is that sort of the area within that you like? I mean, there are life cos as well.
I think, you know, financials, if you look at where we are in the economic cycle, financials would look as a general rule. So whether it's diversified financials, banks or insurance companies, they generally look better than a lot of the traditional defensive sectors of the market. So you think, you know, things more like utilities or staples, because the valuations tend to be a little bit fuller there. The potential for earnings growth generally, historically, at this point in the cycle tends to be a little less. So if there's any upside surprise to the economy and, you know, the yield curve continues to be tilted positively and even more so, then that augurs well for financial stocks to kind of be continued leaders in the market. If growth were to kind of trip up, you know, in the months ahead and we start talking about bond yields falling again and, you know, things becoming a little bit more concerning on the growth side, then that would be a negative for financials. But as I said, we, you know, 18 months ago when I was speaking, we thought the risks were more to the downside than the upside. You've kind of had your event. You've had your economic rollover event. And now you've reset. And so as long as the economy can remain its trajectory on a multi-year basis, then you would think financial stocks, at least relative to some other sectors that I mentioned, the traditional defensive sectors, look a little better.
the traditional defensive sectors and obviously the work from home stocks as well, and it's sort of a big basket, but they've been hit to an extent, some of the big tech I'm thinking about particularly. Multiples is a big question that gets talked about a lot. Valuations themselves were very high. They come off. Where do you see valuations now? What do you think of levels?
It's really, I think when it comes to tech or other kind of high priced stocks, I think it comes down to a bond yield argument. As you've seen the 10-year yield back up here, you know, there's been really no change in our discussion of technology companies that we think are really strong in their respective industries or sub industries, but their valuations of stocks have kind of leveled off or even in some cases come down. And that's really kind of a reset on the valuation, as you mentioned, due to rising bond yields. So I think, you know, I think the most at risk companies, generally speaking, would be those companies that you're really paying like high multiples of sales on way out there in the distance. Like you've priced in a lot of future success. There's a lot of earnings, cash flow, and potentially revenue unknowns. And if bond yields continue to rise, then you're going to discount that a lot more significantly. And that's a headwind from a valuation standpoint for those stocks. So those would be the names I would be most concerned about in one's portfolio, where you have this greater degree of speculation on future success. You've seen this over 100 years in the market. When bond yields start backing up, those companies, or those stocks more specifically, that lend themselves to more speculation about future success are the first ones to come off. And, you know, maybe the revenue and the profit all does come to fruition one day, but you've priced so much of it up front that you then have to reassess your risk and the stocks in turn come off. That's been the traditional pattern.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I want to ask you, we talked a little bit about Canada and big tech in the US. I want to go sort of internationally, but one of the international stories right now is in fact the vaccine rollout, because it's sort of putting certain countries in different levels of snapback or reopening mode. And it just kind of depends on what stage they're at. I know you have a background actually in pharmacology, which I always find fascinating to ask you about what you've seen in the last year on this front. But you know, broadly, what do you think of the vaccine rollout that we've seen globally? I mean,
it's I think when we spoke, you know, about a year ago, you know, I think the first question about a vaccine, do you think it's realistic that we would have vaccines for 2021? And I said, it's a pretty tight window. It's not impossible. It's aggressive, but not impossible. And science came through, you know, in a big way, in a real, real big way. And, you know, I think we all know, from doing anything that requires a massive operational build out or execution, there's going to be bumps along the way. And I think I think some countries have navigated that maybe a little bit better than others, but I'm of the opinion that none of this should be met with a significant amount of criticism. It's easy for all of us to kind of sit back and say, oh, it should have been faster. We could do this better. We could do that better. I'm just very thankful for the science. I think what may be going unappreciated throughout this whole thing is that the technology and the methodology that was used to develop some of these vaccines, not all of them, but some of them, is going to have kind of a high return on investment in the years ahead, whether it's new vaccine development or clinical and therapeutic treatment of future diseases. I think the things that have been learned through this process from a science perspective should not be unappreciated. And so I kind of continue to focus on that. And I think we as Canadians, we'll get there. Well, you know, there's always bumps along the way. I'm kind of ambivalent about it, to be frank. Would it be great if we were kind of sped up here in the process? Sure. That obviously, but I don't think we can, I think we have to be thankful for a lot.
Yeah, it is. I mean, when you look back at how rapid that was to actually get the science through, it is sort of astonishing. So with that said, I mean, there have been discussions certainly that perhaps with the US rolling along faster in many cases than say Europe, Canada also goes into that bucket, that's where you look for sort of the reopening trade faster. But do you perhaps look to Europe now because they will go through that? Or, you know, what are some of the subtleties you look for international investment?
No, I think if you look at it, Pamela, I think the market did a really good job of kind of pricing all this in. It's like if you think back to November when the first announcement was made by Pfizer about their efficacious rates, you know, reopening stocks, hotels, airlines globally just took off. And, you know, the market acting as a somewhat a quasi efficient beast kind of said, we're taking everything irrespective of what countries are going to be vaccinated at a faster rate or what have you, and repriced all of it. So I don't look at thematically there being a difference between countries, if you will. So reopening stocks have kind of been treated the same way globally. So I think from that perspective, I don't see any kind of inefficiencies in the marketplace. I think what we just have to ask ourselves in, you know, T plus one or T plus 2 years is how quickly do the economies continue to expand and how much so? In other words, going back to my pricing power argument, if there is more pricing power than we think on behalf of some of these companies, their profits could expand to the upside. And therefore, further gains in their equities will be attributed more to cash flow and earnings than the valuation reset that we've seen over the last 6 to 12 months.
So interesting. Yeah. So you really have to keep an eye on that area, which is obviously what you're doing. So what happens, Andrew, when the Fed stops buying and starts trying to unload? The party stopping is a big question, isn't it?
Yeah, we saw that before, you know, in the last cycle, right? There was all these kind of taper tantrums that occurred and the markets met with it with some a little bit of angst, you know, a little bit of volatility. I always say, you know, the learning, the lesson that we should have all taken away from last cycle is you just need to be kind of convicted around your long-term goals for that investment and not get shaken out in between. I think it's too noisy. It's too difficult to predict. You kind of don't know when the market's going to kind of really pay attention to it. But I think if you know what your objectives are, not only overall for your portfolio, but your objectives for that stock. One thing I've really tried to hammer home to our analysts over the last 6 to 12 months is like price target. What, like, I don't care what's happening. If I think a certain security ABC is trading at $50 today and I think it's worth $75 in the future, that's a good return. I don't care about the in-between. You know, I don't care if it goes to 52 and then 48 and that, like, I need to be really convicted about that is my goal. That is when I'm going to sell the security. I've given myself a timeline as well as kind of earnings and profits guideposts to kind of get me there. And we monitor that as we go along. If we think the profit and the cash flow are going to be higher than what we had initially thought, then obviously that price target goes up and I need to be convicted on that as opposed to, you know, talks of a taper tantrum and what that does to sentiment and what that does to market multiples in the interim. And I think, you know, pursuant to that 2012 to 2015 analogy that I mentioned earlier, that's what we really did. And that's what I think really helped our portfolios. We didn't get caught up in the other stuff. And that's what I would urge all investors to do is any one investment you have, really think about what is the goal, what's the buy point, what's the sell point, and don't get shaken out of either.
Are there buy points coming along in the months to come? I mean, volatility seems to be some version of a surety in life and certainly in the markets right now. I mean, do you see real opportunities to deploy cash and to get into positions coming?
Yeah, I think one thing that I've noticed in some of our portfolios amongst our team here in Toronto and Montreal has been just a little bit of rotation within some names. So taking some money off the table and some names that we've done well with, so that we think that most of the upside is kind of priced in, and rotating some of that capital to names that haven't participated as much, where we think there's just a better upside versus downside, look at the stock. I think, new names that have kind of come to light in this, not necessarily so because of that rising tides lift all boats type of scenario. So it's more like recycling the capital to names that that we think the investment thesis is largely played out, and we're rotating the capital to names that we just think have better risk reward. We probably already own those names, but it's increasing the concentration of that position within a portfolio.
The portfolio managers that you manage, you sort of had great meetings, I know, in pre-COVID days. Do you still sort of find a way to rally around the table and have your good-hearted disagreements about different types of styles that they have and offer to investors?
Yeah, that hasn't ended, and we're more so than ever really kind of always challenging each of our individual investment theses, right? And it's always great to have such a wonderful large group of talented people who aren't afraid of speaking up and kind of challenging each of us on our analysis and our theses and some of the assumptions and sensitivity analysis we're employing in our financial models and whatnot. And we are constantly doing that. So that hasn't abated at all. In fact, I think the fact that we've kind of come through this over the last 12 months, and now, as I said, we're kind of, I think, turning the page on the market to more of an earnings and cash flow driven market. There's more discussion about being a little bit finer on our estimates and assumptions for those revenue, profits, and cash flow. So I think the tone of the conversation is changing a little bit more and being a little bit more pointed on some of the finer points of our financial modeling.
How often does sort of the theme or the discussion of ESG come up in those conversations, or just more broadly in your own investment, the way you invest, basically?
Yeah, I think sustainable investing, obviously in continental Europe, the Nordic states, and Asia, is probably a lot further on in terms of discussion than it is here in North America, both Canada and the United States. I think sustainable fund disclosure rules are coming to the forefront in continental Europe. There's various articles and requirements on behalf of asset managers that they'll need to fulfill to have their portfolios or their funds properly slotted in one of those articles. And we here in Toronto, Montreal, have the benefit of learning through the experience of our international colleagues in Europe and Asia and what they're going through and what that entails for that industry, such that when it does come over, or if and when it does come over to Canada, which I imagine it will at some point, we're going to be way ahead of the curve in terms of understanding the implications for each of our portfolios. Our portfolio managers will be able to hopefully speak in a very sophisticated fashion about sustainable investing. And we're doing a lot more proprietary research on a lot of ESG related topics within the firm. So it has been a big push on behalf of Fidelity, I would say, for the better part of the last 2 years.
Fascinating. It's lovely to get the conversation going with you, Andrew. Thank you for spending your time here on Fidelity Connects.
Thank you, Pamela. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts. And don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thanks again. See you next time.